Old gray heads have forgotten.
Good afternoon. We will open today's subcommittee. There we go. On public safety, today is February 21st, 2017. And we are going to jump right into a work session on grants. We'll open that work session. What are you laughing at me for? You don't like my pound?
I laughed at you. I got a message from the senator already.
Already? Welcome, Senator Steiner Hayward, via digital doctor world. All right, now I was supposed to be.
Does she have a question about grants already?
LFO, will you please introduce the grant request that we have?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, subcommittee members. The Criminal Justice Commission is requesting approval to apply for up to $1.5 million in federal funds from the U.S. Department of Justice for adult discretionary court grants. Mike Schmidt from the Criminal Justice Commission is here to explain the item.
Excellent. And so if the data genius Mike Schmidt will please explain.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and here to talk to you about the adult drug discretionary grant that we are in the process of applying for. I think it's due at the end of this month. So we are about to put that in. Essentially, you know, it's a $1.5 million grant. We would use that money to supplement our drug courts, our specialty courts. As the committee knows, because I testified last week, that, you know, we're looking at potentially reduced funding for the specialty courts this biennium. So we are trying to find every possible way we can to get more money for those programs. This is not money that we currently receive, although we have received this grant in the past. So it would be an addition and not currently baked into our budget. So asking for permission to go after it, the way we'd use it, we would use $300,000 of the $1.5 million to help us build and keep maintain a data system for drug courts, which currently is defunct across the state. There is a system. It's called OTCMS. It's completely broken down. It no longer works with Odyssey. I think it's on some like 8 versions of Windows ago. And so it's really kind of not very useful. So it would be to help augment that. And then $1.2 million would be passed through directly to Lane and Marion adult drug courts to help them with barrier removal services, transportation, housing, medically assisted treatment, training, education, all the great things that our drug courts fund. All of the money goes through of the $1.5 million. All of the money would be passed through to those two things. None of it would be retained by CJC. To be frank, I don't think we have a very good shot at getting this grant, but, you know, shaking every tree and seeing what we can do, and hopefully we can, but we do use a lot of our burn jag funds, as you already know, to fund specialty courts. And so this would be additional federal money to continue to do that. So we're not entirely optimistic they will give that to us. But like I said, we're going to try.
All right. And CFO, if you can, or LFO, sorry.
No, CFO first.
So right. Get mixed.
Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, Dustin Ball, the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend that you approve the request.
And do we have a motion?
So moved.
I crossed out the wrong thing here. I'm confused. Now you have a recommendation?
Mr. Chair, LFO recommends approval of the grant application request on behalf of the Criminal Justice Commission.
That's my goal, is to make Senator Winters laugh.
She needs it today. Do you want a discussion first before you have a recommendation?
I just got the recommendation. I was hoping to have a motion and then go to discussion.
I move that we give CJC the permission to apply for the grant, because that's with the stipulation that you're not hiring any staff or anything like that, so you don't need to come back.
Great. Is there any discussion? Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the good co-chair asked my first question. So my second question is there any, doesn't sound like it, but is there any ongoing maintenance of effort that's going to cost the state to support this system? I mean, other than what we're already doing through CJC to support the courts.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, all the money would be passed through. There would be no other ongoing costs involved with accepting this grant. We'd put it all towards our specialty court grant funds available, and we'd get it out in the next 3 years to the counties.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up? Go ahead. And why just the two counties? Are those the only places we have these two specialty courts, or what's the deal there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, we worked with these two counties because they're used to there are certain reporting requirements that come with federal grants, and so we have both general fund and federal funded grants. These two courts are used to the requirements that come along with federal funded grants. So because it's $1.5 million, it's only enough to fund a couple courts. So we just teamed up with these two courts because they're used to reporting on those requirements, and that would help us be able to free up some of our other money to support other courts. So we just work with these two because we have a good working relationship and they know how to do the federal reporting.
Thanks. Any other discussion?
I just have another question, because you mentioned that it's not that probable that we would be successful, and so this must be a national competitive grant. Have you had conversation with the grantor to ACSI kind of nurture a little bit?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Winters. Yes, we have, and that's why I think that it's not that likely that we'll end up receiving it, because we are told by the grantor that we're working with that because we already allocate federal funds towards our specialty courts, they're really targeting these federal funds to states that don't spend any money on drug courts, and they want to incentivize those states to get programs up and running. So they let us know that they didn't think our application would be very competitive across other states because we already have a good specialty court system that we use federal funds to support here in Oregon. So we're a little bit punished for the good work that we're doing.
Any other discussion? I appreciate the good work that you guys are doing and that you are making the attempt regardless of how competitive you may or may not be. So this last chance for discussion? Mm-hmm. All right. Are there any objections? Seeing none, then we will pass it on. We need a carrier for Fool. All right. We'll have Rep. Huffman carry it in Fool. And let's see. I will close the work session and open a work session. Do I have to gavel again? Am I supposed to? I'm figuring this thing out.
Why not?
All right. On public hearing, open a public hearing on House Bill 5042, we will pick up from where we left off yesterday.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Stark and Winters, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fairbor Spaksaresh, Director of Oregon Youth Authority. We will continue our presentation. What I want to start with is the OYA Performance Management System. Though some of the slides on the screen are small, we are distributing a paper document so I can walk you through those. My apologies. I know Senator Winters and Representative Peluso have already gone through the pain of going through this document. And I promise not to take that long, and I will make it pretty simple because we have much more exciting testimony here to come, but quite often in state agencies.
Before you get going, a reminder for anybody's watching, the presentation that is on the screen is under yesterday's hearing, and so if you're looking for that anywhere, then you'll find it on under yesterday's date. Sorry.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark. So quite often we talk about transparency and accountability, and this is the process of transparency and accountability that we have put in place in Oregon Youth Authority. We begin with some pretty basic and simple questions that many of you have been in private business, have been in public service for a long time. From my perspective, anyone in any organization should be able to answer these simple questions. What is the business that we are in? What do we want our organizations to be known for? What beliefs guide our actions? What accomplishments will define our success? What's the work that we do in the organization? How does that work get done? Who's responsible and accountable for it? And at the end of the day, what is the measure of our success? Those are the key questions. So with that, I'm going to go to this fundamentals map, which looks pretty maybe impressive and confusing, and I hope within the next 6 or 7 slides break this down in a way that makes sense to all of you. So we're working with this 11x17 paper, and I go to the next slide, which basically has those first three questions. This slide answers the business that we're in. Our business is youth reformation. What we want our organization to be known for is an organization that returns kids to the communities, crime-free, productive, purposeful. And finally, the beliefs that guide our actions are our core values that have been developed by our own staff. The next question is, what accomplishments will define our success? Those are the key goals that appear right under those three blue boxes on this map. And I can read those, but you can basically see these. We started this work just a little over 6 years ago. Again, as far as organizational success, engaged youth, engaged staff, culturally competent, and communicating collaboratively and transparently all the way through the organization. The next question is, what is the work of the organization? And the work of the organization is highlighted in two core processes, operating processes and supporting processes. Operating processes is unique to OYA or any other organization that's in the juvenile justice system similar to ours. So if you look at, for example, managing youth and staff safety, that's a core process. Supporting processes are things that exist in any organization. Things like human resources, information technology, procurement, performance management, etc. The next question is, who's responsible and accountable for these processes? And those are our assistant directors whose initials appear in these boxes right under the core processes and supporting processes. You can see, because this is not an org chart and it's a process chart, there are several assistant directors that are responsible for perhaps a particular core process. For example, managing youth reformation services includes our assistant director for facilities, for community services, our medical director, and the director of our Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. And then the next question in those series of questions was, okay, now that we've defined our work, how does that work get done in the organization? And those are the supporting process, sub-processes that are listed under each core process. So we're basically taking this work and we're breaking it down. So if you go to the third box from the left, OP3, Managing Youth Intake and Assessment, you can see that process then breaks down to a series of sub-processes. This is how this work gets done in OYA. And then the next question is, okay, we now know what work we're doing. How do we measure that work? How do we know that we're doing that work well? And that is that box that appears right under that column, OP3.1. Just take a mental picture of that. I'll come back to that in just a moment. And then finally, what is the measure of our success are the light blue boxes in the bottom of this 11x17 paper. Youth are safe. They feel safe. Staff are safe and feel safe. Youth are healthy. And we can go down this row. And these are basically, if we're doing everything well in this organization, this is what should be happening. These are the outcome of our work. And then at the very bottom, those are the key performance measures that we are required to report to you. And so they're incorporated in this as well. So how does this accountability occur? So in the 11x14 paper that you actually have, this is a sample. Actually, it's a true actual scorecard from our quarterly target review that just took place 2 weeks ago. Every quarter, the organization, all of the process owners come together, and they, in front of the key leaders of the organization, they talk about their measures. So you remember that column under OP, Operational Processes 3. So this basically breaks that down into accountability measures. So OP3.1 is intake RNA completion for facility, and OP3.1B is that same process for our community programs. We have a definition for the measure. Percentage of facility youth whose risk need assessment have been completed within 30 days of commitment. We have some tolerances. You can see we have basically identified where the measure runs in red, yellow, or green. We have an indicator, an arrow that shows which direction this measure should be moving in. We have 2 years of data on this line that shows basically the trend on this data. Then we show the trend and ultimately the owner. So this is how this accountability occurs in the organization. We also distributed to you 8.5 by 11 multi-page paper that is the entire scorecard for Oregon Youth Authority. Again, from the standpoint of transparency, you can see we have over 100 measures, how we're tracking, and you're welcome to attend any of our quarterly target reviews. And if you have any questions as a result of this, and by the way, this measure that I just shared with you on OP 3.1 is also our key performance measure number 6. So many of these measures directly correlate with our key performance measures. The scorecard that I just shared with you actually connects to a divisional scorecard. Before we do our quarterly target review, the work happens in the division, and it could possibly drill down into a work unit. Why do we do this work? Generally, in public sector organizations, we're putting out fires. Everything that I shared with you is operations. It is working in the business. We are not really talking about the strategies. We are not talking about improving the system. We're talking about doing the work well. This process allows us to create capacity so that we can work on the business, meaning that we can begin talking about how do we improve the system, how do we introduce measures and initiatives so that we can move the system forward, we can move OYA forward. And that is a great segue for me to introduce Dr. Shannon Myrick and Kirsten Kolb, who will talk to you about our budget note and about the youth reformation system. But before I do that, any questions? Are you impressed? Or? Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and Stark and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Shannon Myrick. I'm the Development Implementation Manager for the Development Services section of Oregon Youth Authority. And it's a pleasure to be here today to talk about our agency's strategic initiatives. And this is a picture of Stefan, and it's really nice that he is the picture and story for the opening section of strategic initiatives, because in his time with us, he was not only a participant in our programming, but a significant contributor, and even at the very end of his stay with us, a trainer of some of our concepts to our staff related to the initiatives that Kirsten and I are going to share with you today. So he's truly a great example of youth reformation. As you can see from the 2013 legislative budget note, you asked us to develop a business plan to implement the youth reformation system. We have made considerable progress with implementing various components of the YRS, and that will be what I would like to share with you today. But before I get too far into the updates and details, just to refresh everyone's memory or to introduce these concepts for folks who are somewhat new to our work, I want to start with a brief overview of the youth reformation system. And as you can see on the diagram on the right of your screen, we consider the youth reformation system to be that, our system. It's what we do. YRS, and I'll use that acronym throughout my presentation, uses data from Oregon's Juvenile Justice Information System, which you heard about yesterday in our presentation, to conduct research. We review the research from other organizations that are leading our field, and we generate analytic tools that are used to inform the decisions that we make about youth who are coming into the juvenile justice system. And our ultimate goal with this work is to promote both public safety outcomes and outcomes in the lives of the youth that we work with. The youth reformation system has four components, as demonstrated in this graphic. The first component I want to talk very briefly about is our population forecast. This area allows us to better understand the service needs for youth and juvenile justice. For example, how many close custody beds do we need? How many residential beds do we need? Given the needs and risk levels of the youth who are coming into the system today, and the data that we have that indicates our best chance at reducing their recidivism risk. The second component is placement and treatment, and this builds on the momentum from our accurate and data-informed forecasting strategies to help us identify for any given youth coming into the system what is our best course of action in reducing their recidivism risk. The third component is program evaluation, It represents current strategies to determine the effectiveness of programs that we have available for youth in our system, as well as some strategic planning for the future, including how do we measure and account for positive youth outcomes and provide real-time data to our providers so that they can make changes in their programs if they need to meet the needs of our youth. And lastly, community context. And this is really related to the feeder system work that we spoke about yesterday and that Chair Winters is a sponsor of. And this component focuses on situating our work in juvenile justice in a broader landscape through identifying what are those social determinants that could prevent a juvenile justice placement, and further recognizing longer-term outcomes for youth who are exiting our system in terms of employment gains, housing gains, those sorts of things. Additionally, we can analyze data and then provide that information back to communities so that they can begin to make decisions about the issues that they face locally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We introduced a bill yesterday in the House, Cover All Kids. And as you were talking here and talking about social determinants of, we talk about social determinants of health a lot. Are you able to, when a youth comes into the system, are you able to find out things like, did they grow up in poverty? Did they have access to health care? Those kinds of things? Did they have food insecurity? Are you able to determine that and kind of create a model around the kind of kids that are ending up coming into the system?
Co-chairs Winters and Stark, Representative Huffman, with the data set that we currently have, which represents a number of social service databases throughout the state of Oregon, if the youth were receiving services in Oregon and we have the identifier to be able to link them across those data sets, we can have that information available to us. And if it's not available in those data sets because youth are either not from Oregon or don't have that, we don't have a way to track their social history in Oregon, there are certainly opportunities for systems to be asking those questions in the form of an intake document. So there's a number of ways in which we can start to answer those questions utilizing our existing feeder system structure.
Okay, thanks. Just got me thinking.
Okay. The second agency strategic initiative that we want to share with you today is on positive human development. And as we've developed great capacity around the data, the use of that data, we've also become mindful of the importance of our organizational culture. And for the last few years, we've been intentionally developing and transforming our organizational culture to what we refer to as positive human development, or PHD. And in Fairbourn's comments yesterday, he noted that this is rooted in a positive youth development framework and that we've actually expanded it to consider our organization and our staff as developmental partners in these goals. So this culture very broadly encourages us to look at youth and one another as resources to develop. This model is also consistent with a developmental approach, which in the broader juvenile justice landscape across our country is calling upon juvenile justice organizations to acknowledge that adolescents are developing and capitalize on that development and optimize it in ways that we can. Our core practice strategies are centered on helping youth to build skills, getting youth attached to pro-social activities, and engaging them in their communities in positive ways. You can see in the pyramid graphic that safety and security are foundational. And in OYA, we define safety and security as physical, emotional, and psychological safety and security. We believe that without those three things in place, we are much less likely to achieve the outcomes that we seek for our young people. Caring and supportive relationships are viewed as the engines of change. Youth need to know that we care about their success and that we're willing to be a resource in helping them to get there. Central to our model is high expectations and accountability in that third level of our pyramid, and this works best when those expectations are reasonable and rising, and when we are demonstrating accountability on our own part and providing opportunities for youth to internalize a sense of accountability for their own behavior. On the fourth level, you see meaningful participation, and this is where we seek to engage youth in their own case plan and in their communities in ways that can help them support healthy self-efficacy and social identity development. And lastly, the top of the pyramid is community connection. So we're supporting youth in establishing healthy connections to their communities, which the research has shown us is helpful in maintaining safe and crime-free lives. So now that we've had an overview of the two strategic initiatives that I wanted to share with you, I'd like to provide you some key accomplishments that we have in each area. The Youth Reformation System team has delivered trainings across the state on tools that can inform decisions about youth who are entering the juvenile justice system at various points. Predicted success rates and escalation to OIA, which I will describe in a little bit more detail in a moment, are two of the tools that we have been able to share with our partners throughout the juvenile justice system. We've also begun an intensive project centered on reducing the revocation rate for youth who are exiting OIA close custody facilities. And as you can see by the numbers, I'm going to move the hand, more than 140 hours of in-person training throughout the state on the use of data in juvenile justice. We've had 550 youth have a full comprehensive look at all of the data that's available on them. And those are happening in local resource committees, which Kirsten's going to walk us through some scenarios in a minute. 100% of Oregon County juvenile departments have been trained on the use of predicted success rates, and I'll be describing in a little bit more detail what that specifically means. With respect to positive human development, we've also made significant strides in increasing the awareness and knowledge that we have not only within OIA, but with our partners about what positive human development means. We've trained our agency staff in ways that reflect their needs. So what do our direct care staff need to know when they're working with youth in the moment? And what do our managers need to know in supporting culture change throughout our agency? More than 1,100 OIA employees received 12 hours of training in person at their work site throughout our state. More than 160 staff from partner programs and OIA foster parents have been trained in these concepts. And more than 500 hours of training delivered to more than 100 OIA managers and leaders in facilitating culture change.
Just a quick question. Do you have just an ongoing in-house trained staff that is working and training consistently?
We absolutely, Senator Winters, co-chairs, we do. We have the Oregon Juvenile Justice Training Academy, which trains all of our new employees and has ongoing training for existing staff. We have a pretty robust training program available to our team.
Thank you.
Before I move into describing those tools in glorious detail, I wanted to point out that our research agenda is quite robust. And as you heard yesterday about the Juvenile Justice Information System, that includes a wealth of data. And we have a very qualified, highly educated research team in-house at OIA that's able to use that data and provide information to every point in the system. And as you can see on this graphic, we have information that we're working on pre-juvenile justice at the juvenile department level with OIA, and then once youth leave our system. And I think one of the things that's important about the youth reformation system is that we recognize that this is a systemic effort, and to make a change in one point of the system will have an effect in other points of the system. So it's a fairly mindful approach about system change. I'd like to take just a brief couple of minutes talking with you about our youth reformation tools to date, and I'll start with escalation to OIA. Escalation to OIA is a relatively new tool for our youth reformation system. And what it does is predicts the likelihood that a youth will escalate from county probation to an OIA placement. It's important to note that when you look at the broader juvenile justice population in Oregon, only about 20% of youth who are on county probation will find their way into OIA. So what this tool does is it helps counties identify in their jurisdiction who might be the most risky to escalate to OIA. And that can have a number of different effects. It can help us triage. It can help us case plan. It can help us determine what services we might want to reach out and grab for a particular youth who might be high risk for escalating to OIA. And as I mentioned earlier, Kirsten's going to walk through some scenarios that really help bring home how these tools can be used. What we're able to provide counties through the Juvenile Justice Information System is some scores. We'll have two scores with respect to escalation to OIA. What is your risk for escalating for a new crime? And what is your risk for escalating because of a probation violation? In addition to those raw scores, our folks at the county level are able to determine what's the percentile rank for this particular youth. So in Tommy's case, he has a 13% chance of escalating to OIA on a new crime. But of all the kids in his county, he's in the 86th percentile. So we begin to understand in context how risky is Tommy. And if we have limited resources at the county level, where might we place him or her in terms of our services available? Typology is another core tool that was developed within the youth reformation system. And this provides a high-level need profile of youth who are entering our juvenile justice system. And it uses the OIA risk needs assessment, or a subset of those questions, which we refer to as the Oregon typology assessment. What this does is it helps us identify patterns in the needs of youth who are entering the system so that we can effectively distribute resources and programming around those particular profiles. Our research department has found that we have 6 profiles for males and 4 profiles for females. Switching gears a little bit to our predictive tools around risk. ORA and ORA-V are what we refer to as actuarial risk tools that approximate the likelihood that a youth will recidivate. ORA is for general felony recidivism within 36 months of release from OYA close custody or commitment to OYA probation. And that's the threshold that we have, that we report on a regular basis. ORA-V predicts a similar set of crimes, only it's a subset, those crimes that are violent or may potentially be violent. Prior to the development and implementation of tools like ORA and ORA-V, the risk information that we had available to us was limited to categorical, high, moderate, or low. We would conduct a risk assessment and we would know that someone was high risk, moderate risk, or low risk. So having this actuarial risk assessment, which Kirsten will walk us through in a moment, gives us a little bit more information about a particular youth's risk. It estimates that likelihood. So for example, if Fairbors has an ORA score of 60, that tells me that youth like Fairbors have a 60% chance of committing that felony within 3 years of being released from an OYA close custody placement or a commitment to OYA probation. If Kirsten has an ORA of 40%, she has a 40% likelihood. Our tools before might have actually categorized them as the same, high or moderate. And this gives us a little bit more refined picture of a particular youth's risk. Predicted success rates uses both of the tools that I just described, typology and ORA, and it tells us about trajectories that we have available in our system, and specifically which trajectory for a particular youth is most likely to reduce their recidivism risk. And in this case, success is the inverse of recidivism. It's that you did not commit that recidivating crime. And that's a limitation, but as we continue to gather data around positive youth outcomes, we'll be able to understand which placements might benefit youth in terms of achievement. The 3 trajectories that we have available to us right now are remaining in the county on probation, placement in an OYA community placement, or placement in a youth correctional facility. And as I've mentioned, I've been able to give you this high-level picture, but the best way for us to share these tools is through the scenarios. So I'm going to turn it over to Kirsten for that portion.
Thank you, Dr. Myrick. Co-chairs Winters, Stark, members of the subcommittee, my name is Kirsten Kolb, and I am the Strategic Initiatives Analyst with the Oregon Youth Authority. As Dr. Myrick mentioned, I'm going to take you through a couple of scenarios over the following slides to help get a better understanding of how the YRS data is applied to youth-level decision-making. The following scenarios are examples of real youth that we are serving in our system. The names and identifying information have been changed to protect confidentiality. So I'm going to read a couple of scenarios, and then we'll talk a little bit about how the data is applied to youth-level decision-making. The first youth that we're going to talk about is Matt. Matt is a 13-year-old who received his first referral for sex abuse 1. His victim was his younger cousin who does not live in the same household as him. He is living with a paternal aunt and uncle who adopted him at age 3. His biological parents have severe drug dependencies, and Matt tested positive for drugs at birth. Matt is very attached to his aunt and uncle who are very supportive of his treatment process. Matt is engaged in school and attends school on a regular basis. After the completion of the OYA risk and needs assessment, Matt assesses as a typology E. That's one of the 6 male typologies that we have. Typology E youth tend to have low to moderate risk or need factors and high protective factors. Based upon Matt's referral history to the county juvenile department, his ORA score is 6, and his ORA-V score is also 6. Comparing Matt's ORA scores to others across the state and the juvenile justice continuum, Matt's risk to recidivate with a felony adjudication or conviction within 3 years is relatively low. Based upon Matt's ORA score and his typology, we learn his predicted success rates. Matt has an 87% probability of success on county probation, a 92% probability of success in an OYA community placement, and a 79% probability of success in an OYA youth correctional facility. As a reminder, the definition of success in this case is not recidivating. Adding to our next layer of data, Matt also has estimates approximating his probability of escalating to the Oregon Youth Authority. Matt has a 4% probability of escalating on a new crime and a 35% probability of escalating by probation violation. For the new crime, Matt is in the lowest percent of youth when compared to all other youth from his county of jurisdiction. However, he is within the 90th percentile when compared to all other youth to escalate by probation violation. In looking at his predicted success rates, you can see that the OIA community placement estimate is the highest. However, we would consider this not being statistically significantly different than the county probation estimate. One approach with Matt is to provide community services within county probation to ensure that he's able to remain home with his family. Since Matt is most likely to escalate by probation violation, we recognize there is an opportunity to work with Matt and his family in the community on building skills to reduce the likelihood of escalation. So now that we have this scenario under our belt, we're going to turn it over and talk about a young man by the name of Jimmy. What I'd like to do is read a scenario. I'll give you a little bit more information, and then I'm going to turn to you to see kind of where you think the data might lean. So Jimmy is a 17-year-old who was referred to the county juvenile department for harassment of a fellow student. Jimmy lives with his aunt, who he calls his mother. He reports that he is not close to either of his biological parents. Jimmy is involved with the high school football team and wants to open a tattoo shop one day. He struggles with bullying, anger management, and taking accountability for his actions. It is reported that Jimmy's polite, receptive to feedback, and follows directives. However, he has recently shown unstable behavior in the community. Jimmy has several referrals, including reckless burning and theft. Jimmy has a history of substance use, but he has been clean for several months. So, based upon Jimmy's RNA, or risk needs assessment, he is assessed as a typology F. What we know about typology F youth is that they tend to have moderate to high risk or need factors and very few protective factors. We also know that Jimmy's score is a 26 on his ORA, his OIA recidivism risk assessment, and a 10 for his ORA V. Comparatively to other youth statewide, this estimates Jimmy is in the moderate to high risk to recidivate. So based on what you've learned about Jimmy to date, where would you expect the data to suggest that he would best be served? County probation, OIA community placement, or an OIA youth correctional facility?
You've all looked ahead on the slides.
Oh no. Not all of us. Chair Stark, thank you for your honesty.
What were that three options again?
It's, Co-Chair Stark and Winners, Representative Peluso. It is county probation, OIA community placement, and OIA youth correctional facility.
Well, I'll go with county probation because I'm a softie, but.
Co-Chair is Representative Peluso. As you can see, his estimates of success are very close in all three environments.
Wow, look at that.
This was a really tough case, as there is not a clear, distinct environment with a significant statistical difference for placement. This youth would likely be successful with the right services and supports in any environment. And considering his probability of escalation to OIA, Jimmy has a score of 10 for a new crime and a 19 for a probation violation. As indicated before, approximately 20% of youth escalate to OIA. Jimmy at present does not fall within the highest probability of escalation within his county. In considering Jimmy's case, one approach would be to serve him on county probation, with an understanding that an OIA community placement may be necessary to ensure healthy skill building and public safety.
Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Chair Stark. So I've always been fascinated by this man's work and trying to figure out how all it works. I would contend that outside of what you all are doing, that young man would have been in jail or county probation. So I just applaud the efforts, and it's, again, amazing. And I get frustrated that we aren't able to, I'm sure we have made the efforts to share throughout our state and counties. People need to pay better attention to this.
Co-Chair Winters?
I just need to pile on, because this is actually exceptional, and the good director and I, we also are having the same conversation with Director Psyche, because this particular tool and what they're doing and the assessment work, we think, can be replicated over in DHS. And it bears out, you know, we talked yesterday about some of the dinner meetings that I've had with the directors of looking at not only the sharing of data and information, but this particular tool and others. The question becomes of the investment up front, because when Fairbourse was started, we talked about this, and we have to be willing on this side also to recognize as a policy that these are useful management tools that will assist in the work that the agencies are doing. And so I need to put that there, and I know that Fairbourse is sharing the work that's being done at OYA with others. I also, and he probably won't toot his own horn, but I suspect that we're a rarity here in Oregon in the juvenile field.
Co-chair Senator Winters, I'm always happy to take credit for others' work. Representative Pluson knows that. We went as a delegation from Oregon to Austin last year, where the Council of State Government in the 50th State Forum, Oregon was the only state that was actually asked to present in the work that's happening around data and analytics. And you can see why I'm excited to work with such smartly certified people. I'm not certified, but they are. But really what I want to do is just take a few moments and ask Kirsten and Shannon to talk about how this work is actually happening on the ground with the counties, because this is not hypothetical work. This is, we're actually staffing together, county and state, on every single unit.
But before we go on, I have my own question and a Senator Steiner Hayward question. Senator Hayward asked back to Matt and Jimmy. Mm-hmm. She didn't tell me if she looked ahead or not, but she says, can you comment as to why would Jimmy be so much less likely to have a probation violation than Matt? Says, looking at it intuitively, that doesn't seem to make sense. If you can comment on that, and then I have a question about the overall budget as well.
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, members of the subcommittee, that's a great question. So let me just take a look at my data here really quick to make sure that I understand the question from Senator Steiner Hayward. So the question is why Jimmy was more likely, or why Matt was more likely to escalate by probation violation than Jimmy, and that seems counterintuitive. That's a great question, and part of that is that the variables that go into the equation of the new crime estimate and the probation violation estimate differ. And one of the variables that goes into that probation violation is a sex offense disposition. And so since that youth has a sex offense disposition, that variable is a very significant predictor of escalation by probation violation. So that alone will increase that youth's likelihood of escalating by probation violation.
And Parker?
So and I'm just kind of curious, so that Jimmy's 17, and so he turns 18, he moves away, and then he commits another crime. But you know about that? I mean, because once he's 18, he's not coming back to OYA, right? So how do you track? I mean, I'm just wondering when they become adults, the 13-year-old, I can see where you're going to be tracking him for a while. But once they're an adult and gone.
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, and Representative Barker, thank you for asking that question. We do continue that tracking of you through the Department of Corrections as well. So we maintain that communication to make sure that we're receiving that data about youth that may have recidivated after the age of 18.
And if they leave the state, you may or may not get it.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And before you tell us, as was requested a minute ago, like what this work looks like at the county level, you may have said this early on, maybe I was just so baffled by these charts and everything that I didn't hear it, but how long have you been doing these sorts of predictive analytics, and how accurate have you been?
Co-Chair Stark, great question. And I actually have some numbers for you today around the accuracy of our data. We have been engaging in this process for the past couple of years, I would say approximately about 3 years. And we have incrementally rolled out these tools to not become overwhelming to the system, recognizing that using data to inform decision making can be incredibly, it's new within working with within social services and applying that to the youth that we're working with. So we're being very mindful about how quickly we're rolling out each new piece of information. So if you give me just one quick moment, I will let you know specifically about the accuracy of this information. Let's see here. For Aura and Aura V, we have an accuracy of approximately 69%. So 50% obviously would be the coin toss within data and research. 69%, almost 70% is excellent. And it definitely is consistent or even improved in comparison to some of the other risk tools that we use in serving our youth population. For predicted success rates, we have a range. For county probation, it's at about 64%. OIA community placement, it's at about a 66% accuracy. And within an OIA youth correctional facility, we're at about almost a 69%. The newest tool, escalation to OIA. For the new crime estimate, we are with a predictive accuracy at approximately 74%. And with a probation violation, we're at 79%, which is quite incredible.
Mm-hmm. And if impressive. I might add, our feeder system analysis, which Senator Winters knows about, mm-hmm. that accuracy is just around 81%. And again, that's primarily why we rely on professional discretion. We don't want tools to make decisions for kids.
Right.
So we're going to pass over our last example.
Can we go back just a little bit? Because yes. You talked about the implementation the last 3 years or so. But there was prior work before the implementation. I don't want to give mm-hmm. the misimpression that there was not work that took place before actually beginning the rollout.
Co-chair Senator Winters, that's absolutely correct. Actually, I should give DOC credit. My partner in DOC, Colette Peters, who was the director of our agency and is responsible for helping us bring Dr. Paul Baladi from DOC into OIA. We work very closely with Criminal Justice Commission, with Mike Schmidt, and these tools have been in the process of development for the past 6 years. And, I actually highlighted this in one of our previous presentations in the years past. One of the very first examples of this, these predictive tools were about 6 years ago, where prior to that time, Joe yesterday explained that there are two different flow of youth that come into our system from the adult court and from the juvenile court. From the adult court system, those youth are in our physical custody, but legal custody of the Department of Corrections, and at any point they can be sent to DOC for behavior, for fighting, for assaulting, etc. And up to about 2009, we did not have any predictive tools to tell us if we are actually increasing or decreasing the probability of recidivism for those youth if we send them to DOC. Right around 2009, we started developing those tools. Do you have a slide regarding? We don't have a slide on that. But I can tell you that in 2009, we sent 41 kids to DOC for misbehavior. Then we found out that those youth that actually transferred to DOC for behavior recidivate almost as twice the rate as those kids who finished their time with us. So as a result of that, that number has dropped to 4 from 41. So that is, again, the power of these predictive tools. Now, around the culture change piece of it, it's a very difficult conversation to have with staff. Co-Chair Stark, I know you know about this. You've worked in these facilities. And putting staff's life at risk by keeping a kid who's possibly assaulting. But if we see that we're actually significantly increasing the probability of recidivism, then we work harder with that kid. And in some cases, we fail. But at least we now have the data to guide us as to, again, not 100% accurate, but on the research scale, pretty good. Thank you.
Carry on.
Thank you. So through the implementation of the tools within the youth reformation system, we've observed significant impact both at the youth level decision making and the improvement to our system to better serve Oregon's youth within the juvenile justice system. And I really want to talk about these bullet points up here that have the impact to youth and the impact to the system. And the best way I feel like I can describe this is through a couple of examples. In Clackamas County, we had a young man under the supervision of the Oregon Youth Authority who was appearing before the court for a probation violation. Recommendations for this young man's next placement varied, including placing him in another residential program or possibly escalating him into a youth correctional facility. The juvenile parole and probation officer assigned to this case presented the youth's case, including the youth's YRS scores within predicted success rates. The predicted success rates indicated that he would be most successful in an OIA community placement. The presiding judge hearing this case ruled to allow this young man another opportunity in a residential placement. I spoke with the supervisor of the juvenile parole and probation officer just this morning up in Clackamas County. And this young man is doing well. He's in a current placement where he's receiving further assessment. He is stable and he's engaged. So this is a perfect example, or a great example, where we're seeing how the YRS data informs placement and planning and services for individual youth. The second story I'd like to share with you is about how this is having an impact on our system. We've had several counties, including Wasco County, make significant efforts to engage youth, families, and stakeholders for planning and to wrap services around youth and families and decrease recidivism. The focus of this effort is to identify youth at greatest risk for escalation. After they identify the youth needs, they are contacting appropriate community partners and stakeholders and bringing them all to the table and having a conversation about what's going on with this youth and this family, and how can we as a community wrap services around this youth and family to prevent that escalation and divert that youth from escalating into the Oregon Youth Authority. This effort has demonstrated significant success with several youth. Not only have the youth remained in the communities with their families, but we're also seeing that they're showing a reduction in their probability of escalating to OIA.
So we've definitely shared a tremendous amount of information with you all today, and our work has really just begun. It feels like it's been 6 years in the making, and we continue to march forward with how to best use data and research in Oregon's juvenile justice. And while we continue that focus to implement and use the information that we've just shared, I wanted to share with you our next steps in terms of what we're focused on. We are focused on creating a dynamic risk score that will reflect a youth's risk at any point in time and that captures and recognizes what they have accomplished in the terms of treatment and skill building and how that might impact their recidivism risk. We're focused on using data and research to inform us on when the best time is to transition a youth to an environment of less restriction so that we avoid not keeping a youth long enough or keeping them too long, and what that impact has on their recidivism risk and their overall success. The feeder system studies as an important body of work to inform juvenile justice and situate it in our broader social landscape. We're working on focusing on how to implement those findings and what the next phase of studies needs to be for the feeder system. And lastly, we continue to focus on strengthening our culture of positive human development because it's so critical in understanding how to use this information wisely in the effort to create safer communities and increase our opportunities for positive youth outcomes. Thank you very much for your time. I'm going to turn it back over to our director, Fairbors.
I actually think we're doing okay on time. Do you want to cover that scenario three? Or would you like another scenario?
Yeah, I looked at the slides.
I can predict what's going to happen.
Cheating.
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, we'll talk about this last scenario around TJ. TJ is a 16-year-old with extensive involvement in the juvenile justice system. He has three brothers who all have different fathers. TJ currently lives with his mother and her current partner, but has spent time in foster care while his mother was in treatment for substance abuse. TJ's older brother and father have both spent time in prison. He does not get along with his mother's current partner. He would like to get a job to save up for skateboarding camp. TJ is behind in his education, but is willing to get a GED. His referrals include burglary, minor in possession, curfew offense, and runaway. TJ did experience physical abuse and neglect by his mother and her current partner, and he has had thoughts of suicide. Based upon the completion of his assessments, TJ is assessed as a typology C. Typology C youth tend to display moderate to high need factors with moderate protective factors, with a focus on addressing mental health needs. TJ's aura score is a 40 with an aura V of 24. Based upon what you've learned about TJ, where would you expect the data suggest he'd be best served for those who haven't looked ahead? County probation, OYA community placement, or an OYA youth correctional facility?
Representative Peluso.
community placement.
Residential, community residential. Co-chairs Winters and Stark, Representative Peluso. TJ's estimates of success indicate he would be most successful served on county probation.
Right. That's 73.
Knowing TJ has some trauma and mental health needs, it is necessary to ensure he has services and interventions to support his success. Should TJ's needs rise above what resources are available in his county of jurisdiction, TJ may need an OYA community placement that ideally represents a normalized environment.
So can you start with county probation and work towards community placement?
Co-chairs, Representative Peluso, absolutely. Certainly in the juvenile justice system, we look to serve youth in the most restrictive environment. In this case, such as
least.
What
least.
Did I say? Most yeah, restrictive. Most, yeah. Pardon me. Least restrictive
least
environment.
That was the old days.
Yeah, really. Pardon me. Least restrictive environment. And certainly with proper planning, hopefully we would prevent that escalation. However, should TJ's needs rise to what can be offered in the local community, then certainly that escalation may need to occur to ensure his reformation and public safety.
And I'll always go with somebody who wants a tattoo parlor versus a skateboard shop.
Yeah, really.
But there was a real key here, and that was the, and I try to listen that if the treatment availability or what's there in the case planning, if the county is not there,
right.
He may be having to go to the community placement.
Mm-hmm.
Or the, yeah. And that, you know, and I've talked about that we need to do a much better job of doing some mapping across the state of what is available in our various counties, particularly when we talk about resources, because there are gaps that exist. So I'll leave that for another committee. But I know in talking to Fair Boers and others, when we look at placement of youth and individuals, that all is not equal in the state of Oregon.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, the gap conversation is an important one, because this work is allowing us to understand what needs currently exist and how they can be addressed. So Co-Chair Stark yesterday asked about our residential beds and how some of those providers have disappeared. We are in the process of basically realigning our residential system based on some of this work that has happened and identifying the need, so that we don't get in a situation that we have long waiting list for one residential provider and another one that has empty beds that they can't fill. So again, the data and the work is informing that decision making. We're just at the front end of that process. And finally, I want to mention that this is a pretty unique work that's happening around the country. The only other state that's doing something similar to this is Florida. And again, I think the significance of this work is that it's happening inside the agency. We're not paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to outside consultants to come and leave us with a nice document that we could not deliver. So we're learning, and the most exciting part of this is that our county partners are at the table and helping us learn.
So I'd like to ask, too, so along those lines with the different counties, I mean, it's got to be totally different for a kid from Portland to somebody who lives in Grant County. And I don't know. I mean, in fact, there's a murderer who's getting paroled, and he's going to go, and they're going to set up things that he needs to do. He's living in a trailer in Monument, Oregon. I mean, there's nothing to do.
Yeah.
I don't know. but he's an adult. But I mean, I just wonder, like a kid in Grant County where there's not much in the way of resources and funds.
Co-chairs.
How could we help? I mean, yeah. What can we do to help solve
Representative Walker, one of the challenges that we have, and in fact, we hear this from judges, that they commit kids to us because local resources do not exist.
Yeah.
So I think the first step is identifying the gap that exists in the local community. And in some cases, actually, youth are better served away from their local communities, depending on what's happening, especially in gang involvement, et cetera.
Right.
And some of those youth choose not to go back to those communities after they spend some time with us. So again, a part of this work is really individualizing the treatment to the specific needs of the youth. Years ago, we talked about evidence-based practices. We talked about, you know, aggression replacement therapy produces $55 and $1 invested. But that really didn't get to the question, well, does that work for this kid? It might work for an aggregate number of kids, but does it work for this particular youth? And I think that's where you're getting to, and that's where we're trying to head to.
Okay, thank you.
Sharon and Kirsten.
All right, 10-year plan.
I'll ask Rex Emery, our facilities manager, to come and join us. And again, as we transition to the next stage, I am extremely fortunate and blessed to be able to work with such professionals and as Shannon and Kirsten and Rex and others who really are moving this work forward in Oregon Youth Authority. The next slide is, again, Joe talked about Gustavo yesterday, and this quote is simply around our physical environment and the relationship that physical space has to reformation of youth. When we go to our budget note from 2013 legislature, we see that we were instructed to evaluate our facilities in terms of capacity, operating and maintenance costs and deferred maintenance, create a 10-year plan and bring it back. Including that recommendation, facility disposition, the focus was on the two large facilities that we had in the Valley, McLaren and Hillcrest, with significant deferred maintenance. And those of you who have been to Hillcrest, it's a beautiful facility, but it's an interior structure and not only not exactly aligned with our positive human development approach, but in terms of seismic, it's significantly lacking. So the specific instructions was that in the business plan that we brought back, maximize asset utility and effective use of taxpayer dollars, create timeline for the project and the implementation of the youth reformation system. And again, in this process, they wanted us to do the maximum that we could to avoid layoffs. So with that, you heard about the youth reformation system. Now we talk about our facilities. In following the guidance and direction of the budget note, we hired a internationally known company through a competitive procurement process, DLR, that builds stadiums, correctional facilities, schools, etc. And they in turn hired a subcontractor, Chin Planning, who specifically focuses on a developmental approach for youth correctional facilities. What they came back and told us is that the current mix of facilities within the OYA system does not support the vision, mission, and culture of OYA. Housing and living areas reflect the most serious gap between vision and reality. The majority of youth are housed in densely populated dormitory living units, and program and treatment space is not adequate to support relief and breakout space. The pictures that you see in this slide is a picture of our GEAR unit at McLaren and the Sigma living unit at Hillcrest. The next slide, you can see again some of the stuff that I just shared with you in adequate space, high density living units. On the left, you can see the picture of a medical clinic at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility. And on the right, this is a picture of a dorm in Tillamook Youth Correctional Facility. So what we've done with the 10-year plan is that we brought back a plan that was approved by the legislature in 2015. We are scheduled to close Hillcrest and combine it with McLaren. By July of 2017, I mentioned yesterday that we may be running a month or so behind the schedule, primarily due to weather and soil conditions that the contractor has faced. We hope to complete that project not too far beyond the scheduled date of July 2017. We are building 6 new units, 16-bed living units to reduce density. And to close Hillcrest, we are going to fully, ultimately, renovate all of our living units. But because, again, escalating costs of construction, et cetera, we had to bring that plan back and do some of it in phase two. The project also resolves our deferred maintenance, which is significant in these old buildings. And we are establishing an intake center at McLaren. The next slide is a picture, aerial picture of McLaren campus. You can see our existing 8 living units. The Grover remodel is a full remodel of an existing living unit. We were able to do that with existing funds. The rest of the 7 living units have received cosmetic upgrades. And then you can see the new 6 new living units on the right side of the east campus. These are the intake units. Three of them would be the intake units that the Hillcrest population will transfer to. When we talk about renovating that one living unit, we're really taking it all the way down to the structure and building it back up again to also address seismic issues and with a hope of a 50-year lifespan for these new units. This is an example of a visual change between. On the left, you can see a intake unit at a day room at one of the living units at Hillcrest, and what it would look like in the new facility. Senator Winters yesterday talked about the line of sight and how we were talking about PREA, and she mentioned that if you don't really have good line of sight, you can't be supervising kids and adults. And the new living units have been built with that in mind. When you tour McLaren later this week, you're not going to be able to see the brand new living units, but you can see the one unit that has been totally remodeled, and you can see that there's a significant difference in improving the line of sight in these new units. This is a contrast between an individual room in our gear compound, which looks very institutional, almost like a jail or prison cell. And then you can see what it will look like in the newly renovated, or actually these would be the new units, the 6 new units that we're building. So the population that's currently residing in this other gear living units will be moving there. And again, partly very important because part of this population, acute mental health issues, suicidal tendencies, et cetera. So living environment, physical environment, is extremely essential as we move forward. This is an outside picture of that gear unit that I just shared with you, and on the right would be the picture, outside picture of one of the new living units that's being built. Again, much more feeling like a college campus versus a prison environment or a correctional facility.
And you're going to Gear will still be there, but just remodeled?
Co-chairs, Senator Barker, gear will be there for a period of time. We have plans to demolish that ultimately. And the reason that we're keeping it is because we were not able to totally remodel the other 7 front units.
Yeah.
We need physical space to move youth back and forth so that we can accomplish that.
And when were those built? Those are ancient. When were those built?
The gear units? 1950s, and the front cottages early 1960s. Yeah. And then again, this is a picture of before and after the cottage that has been totally remodeled. You can see the dorm environment and then also the showers. Again, line of sight, much more, still a youth correctional facility, but much more aligned with positive human development, natural lights, and by doing this, we are also eliminating about $400,000 in deferred maintenance in these units. Representative Stark, you may not want to look at this picture, but this is the new high school in our youth correctional facility in Grants Pass. The challenge that we had in that facility is that it has a population of 100, our most densely populated youth correctional facility in the state after McLaren and Hillcrest will be the second one after we close Hillcrest, but in a very small environment, four living units of 25. School is actually happening on the living unit. So this new school building is not just school. It actually serves for visitations, family events, evening activities, indoor and outdoor treatment groups. And by moving schools out of the living units, it allows them more programming space and really a much more normalized feeling and environment around going to school. If you go to our youth correctional facility in Tillamook with the camp, we built a school there several years ago, and it has significantly improved. Kids who want to go to college, education outcomes, etc. So we are pretty optimistic that this will help us get there. There's also a sports field that's being built. Ultimately, what we're going to end up with is currently the 100 kids. I think we have a bit less, fewer kids in that facility right now, but when we have 100 kids there, basically the only space, 1.25 acres is the space that they have access to. It's pretty small. We're going to expand that to 10 acres to, again, our own property. We'll expand the fence and put in sports field to allow our kids to be able to, again, that positive human development and a developmental approach. This is, again, just the next slide is a contrast between a classroom or a room that has no light, no pictures, and then the new space that will be created. I'm going to ask Rex.
Hold on. Before you go on, sure. Just comment. If you're looking at the slide 104 and you see the before and after, one of the things that you don't see in that picture, as the director just mentioned a minute ago, is that picture on the before is actually taken from the milieu or the living area. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is that it doesn't take much chaos in their general living space to completely shut down and distract all learning that happens in that room. And so that's why it's so important that we actually have a classroom or school or something external from that area, so that if something happens in your general living area, you're not disrupting an entire school day. So anyway.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark. And I know you speak from experience as well.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yes. So this next slide is actually, it's a pretty cool project, and I wanted Rex to talk about this. This on the left is our Tillamook Youth Correctional Facility, mm-hmm. and basically changing our heating and cooling system.
And a heads up, we have about 15 minutes for about 15 slides.
Yes, I'll be fast.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rex Emery, and I'm the facilities manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. So at Tillamook, we replace an old and outdated heating and cooling system with a new ground source geothermal heat pump system. A geothermal heat pump is a heating and cooling system that transfers heat to or from the ground in loops that are buried under the ground. That's what that image shows when we were burying the loop. And this type of system can be three times more efficient than a propane system, which is what we had there, or up to six times more efficient than an electric system. For this project, we also took advantage of the need to rehab the rec field there. The rec field, you know, had rocks and had become uneven over the years, and since we were trenching, we actually rehabilitated that field. And then at Eastern, we replaced five package heating units. And that image shows that. What's significant about that, and really about all the projects that are happening in the facilities outside the I-5 corridor, is the lack of contractor interest. We tend to get one, maybe two bids per project. At Eastern, the bid we got for that project was $1 million over our architect's estimate, the first bid, and it was only one bidder. So we rebid it. We reduced the scope somewhat. We held some bidders workshops to help local contractors understand the state system a little bit better, and ended up with a successful second bid for about $600,000.
Thank you for not trying to close that again. I talked to everybody that lived up there on the phone, that all the residents who did not want that to close.
Co-chairs, Representative Barker, the impact to the local community would be huge.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's one of the challenges currently. As I understand, we're the second largest employer in Burns, Oregon, after Safeway.
At that time, the next level down was Safeway.
Right.
There wasn't that many jobs there. I mean,
absolutely. You're absolutely correct. While the rest of the state has actually gone through a robust economic recovery, that area has not experienced that. Thank you, Rex. The next slide basically says the work that's ahead, rebuilding the 7 living units at McLaren, renovating. While we talked about the school at Rogue Valley, we have not done anything to the living units there, addressing our deferred maintenance at all of our facilities, and continue aligning our physical infrastructure with positive human development and improve spaces containing vocational programs. Thanks, Rex. Co-Chair Stark just reminded me we don't have a whole lot of time, and I don't intend.
But I will point out, tomorrow we will be having public testimony, but
right.
You guys do have some time slotted for tomorrow,
sure.
As well.
Sure. Well,
so.
Hopefully we can get through this today, because I don't know how many people are. I know a lot of people expressed interest to come to do public testimony, so hopefully they can get enough time. This next slide is one of our girls, one of our young women in Miranda, in our transition facility at Oak Creek. And she's really, what she's doing here, she's talking about the space. Because before, we just piloted this program about a year and a half ago with internal funds. We had closed our only female transition program, which used to be Corvallis House, back in 2009. We built a brand new building, but did not have funds to operate it because of the reductions that we went through in 2010 and 11. So we just opened that last year, and she's talking about how space makes a difference, how just having a bunk bed that looks like a bunk bed at home is different than a bunk bed that's so institutional and made of metal. And we are learning that, of course, through our own experiences and through our own research. So just the next few slides are about our historical and projected spending, long-term vacancies. You asked us about that yesterday, the governor's budget reductions and the 15% reduction, and the only agency bill that we have. This next slide highlights our budget in the past and moving forward to the future. And it's important to note that anything past 2013-15 is actually projected. You can see the real budgets up to 2013-15 because we are done with that biennium. This biennium and moving forward are all projected. You can also see that we have had a significant increase. That highlighted yellow area is our bond funds, that the $49 million or $50 million that we received for renovating our facilities, and that continues into the next biennium with the ask what we actually end up with, what happens, we don't know. These are simply projections. The next two slides basically are sub-slides of the slide that we just looked at. It now goes into our three budget areas: community services, facility services, and program support. And again, you can see the breakdown with federal funds, other funds, and general funds. You can see that in our community programs, we receive probably the most federal funds that we receive in our agency because of our residential programs that don't have fence around them. That those are those BRS providers that we receive nearly a 50 or 60% match, federal match for the programs that are provided. And again, you can see the trajectory and what is projected all the way up to 2021-23 biennium. The next slide, as I said, now shows facility services up to 2013-15. Again, actuals, and then anything after that projected. You can also see that we had a slight increase in population around 2007-9 biennium, and then a decrease, and then it's projected to basically level off going forward into 2019-21 and 21-23. And then you go into program support, and again, projected versus what we see in the future. What factors actually into this slide is inflation, step increases, PERS, healthcare, state government service charges, mass transit. There's some other expenditures that are included in this budget, and that's the move of some of our IT infrastructure to the state data center, and resolution to some of the long-term double fills that we've had in technology, in investigation, and one position for our Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations. We were asked yesterday about our vacancies, and this chart basically highlights the number of vacancies that we have. 41 vacancies, 12-plus months, and I'll explain those in detail. And four vacancies over the course of the past 7 to 11 months. The largest number of the vacancies for the 41 is that number 15 that you see. Those 15, there's a story behind that. Those are 15 vacancies with no funding attached to them. Way in the past, prior to my time, OYA apparently was running a couple of detention programs. We are co-housed with counties in some of our facilities, and the counties actually run the detention. OYA runs the youth correctional facility. These positions were placed in our budget with no funding so that if the county did not want to continue operating those programs, we could step in and operate the program, and then the county would pay us for those services. So those are vacant positions sitting there, and they cannot be used for anything else in OYA. They're basically on the books. Now, what happens with the rest of these numbers? The 13 positions, and keep in mind that in consolidating McLaren and Hillcrest, when we move from a 135 facility with 135 kids now to a facility with 270 kids, some positions are needed, some other positions are not needed, and some positions needed to be repurposed. So basically what's happening here, these 13 positions are funding other positions. Six of those positions are basically double fill. It is related specifically to the consolidation of Hillcrest and McLaren, so that when we move into McLaren, they will be repurposed and these positions will be filled. We are actually using them to fund other positions. These, there is one position that's a program support position in Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations that, again, is funding a different position until it's established. And then there are there are four positions. I talked yesterday about the difficulty that we have in hiring health professionals. These are nurses. There's actually RNs and a dentist that we are not able to hire, but we're using the funding to contract for these positions. We advertise, we can't hire, we contract. If we hire somebody, then we'll fill those positions. And then the 7 to 11 month, again, there's just actually one position that's funding other position. Two recruitments are already in progress. And then the one position, it's a net zero position. Basically, we have a package that does not cost the state any money. We're basically following the direction that we see through our budget note to repurpose our position so that we can fund things like the YRS or the positive human development.
Mr. Chair.
Sure. So basically, it sounds like you really have no true unfilled positions. And the reason I bring this up, in 2011 we came in and we worked with agencies because DHS balanced the budget. Governor Kulongoski did the 9% across the board cuts, and DHS balanced their 9% by saying we're not going to fill 500 unfilled positions. I'm like, why in the world do you have 500 or more unfilled positions that you are getting funded and you don't have them? You come in and you tell us you have them, but then what do you do with the money? And so that's, I just want to, I'm trying to be totally above board. That's where the question's coming from. And in tough budget times, you know, if all agencies, you find 200 unfilled positions that really have been unfilled for the purpose of receiving money to use for other purposes, it can be a lot of money.
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, I appreciate that. Again, we can provide full accounting of these things, and you're correct. We don't really have any true vacancies. Everything is pretty much spoken for, but at any point we'll sit down and go over any details with you.
Quick follow-up. On facilities, I don't know if you talked about facilities while I'd been out testifying, let me know. Interested in the capital construction, and part of that is taking care of some of the deferred maintenance.
Right.
Deferred maintenance is a pet peeve of mine. I don't think we should have it, but I know it's quite common, and I'm trying to figure out at some point how can we. So in your process, do you identify the full amount? Have you worked with DAS to figure out what your total backed up deferred maintenance is? So that we can start trying to get a grip on this?
Absolutely. Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, yes, we have a number for our total deferred maintenance. The challenge is we've never been funded to take care of those. And the plan that we currently have basically by 2023 gets us to where we could fully address the deferred maintenance. Again, we'd be glad to sit down with you and go over that.
The fact that you have a plan is encouraging because I don't hear that.
Yeah.
Final question.
Go ahead.
When facilities are shut down, the Warrenton facility,
right,
is it owned by the state?
Yes, Representative Huffman, owned by the state.
Will it be sold then?
There is a process that we go through. The process offers that facility to state agencies first, then to local stakeholders, and then ultimately it can put it up for sale through a process, and nonprofits, others can bid on it, and we will follow that process.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on that requirement, DAS works with the agency, and it has to go through this rigorous offering, and it takes a little while before it actually gets to the private sector, because you have both, first the state agency, then the county and city, and those jurisdictions before it can ever get to the private sector. That's one of the, it takes us a while, for land to become available for private sale.
Thank you. I wanted some clarification, because when we shut down the School of the Blind, it seemed like that ended up in private hands fairly quickly. Not that I'm complaining, I'm just saying it didn't seem to
Well, there were two things on that one. As you know, there were several working prior to when we finally did get, and thanks to Senator Geltzer, to get that completely done. The other is that Salem, and this is the only city, by the way, only place across the state where there is capital planning. So everything that happens with land or here in Salem actually goes through a rigorous process before anything is either built that is of a public, the state entity, or goes to the market. So capital planning is engaged, and I serve on that, and I can't know who the House member, as well as the City of Salem. So that planning for properties that are owned by the state or buildings that are owned by the state often happens way in advance before things happen.
Senator Frederick.
Thank you. And in other places like Portland, many of the school properties have a covenant on them that basically immediately is turned over to, it goes down that same process. If the district decided to sell a school property, it would not sell it easily, because it needs to, especially if there's a school on it, It has to then go to often to a private, to the city or to the county or to some other public entity, and again, sort of down the process. So you'll see in a lot of the school properties in Portland that have been leased, long-term leased for a certain amount of money rather than sale because they couldn't. We ran into that quite easily.
We are going to save revenue and budget for tomorrow.
Sure.
We'll open up with that and then go to public testimony. A reminder that the plan is Thursday for many of us to take a field trip and tour out to McLaren. Hopefully many of us can attend that. And on that note, we will close our public hearing on House Bill 5042, and we will adjourn.
Thank you, Coach.
We will adjourn.
Thank you, Coach.
We'll be